This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. U.S. President Donald Trump briefly left the military hospital where he is being treated for COVID-19, riding in a vehicle to greet supporters gathered outside. Mr. Trump departed the hospital in an armored SUV and remained in the vehicle as he drove past a flag-waving and cheering crowd outside Walter Reed National Military Medical Center. Mr. Trump teased his surprise departure in a brief video posted to his Twitter page. He said to be very eager to resume campaigning. And White House Press Secretary Kayleigh McEnany said on Fox News that Mr. Trump is very hopeful about getting out there in short order and then when the doctors deem it appropriate. Trump tested positive for the coronavirus late Thursday, 2 days after debating with Democratic nominee Joe Biden in Cleveland, 2 weeks to the day before their next scheduled face-off in Miami. Biden has since tested negative. State and county officials in the state of New Jersey are contacting more than 200 people who were at President Donald Trump's Bedminster Golf Club for a campaign fundraiser Thursday and asking them to monitor themselves for possible coronavirus symptoms. Anyone who was in close contact with the president or his staff is being asked to quarantine for 14 days. Officials recommended waiting 5 to 7 days from the event to get COVID-19 tests to prevent false negatives. After the White House announced early Friday that President and Mrs. Trump had tested positive for the coronavirus, it sent the New Jersey officials a list of 206 people who attended these events. Local officials are contacting employees who work there as well. This is VOA News. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson defended his handling of the coronavirus pandemic Sunday, despite weeks of rising infections, but he warned that the country faced a bumpy winter ahead. Britain has Europe's highest coronavirus death toll, and Johnson's conservative government is facing criticism from all sides. Opponents are calling for tougher social restrictions to suppress a second wave of COVID-19 that's already sweeping the country, but many in Johnson's right-of-center party argue that restrictions must be eased to save the battered economy. Johnson told the BBC the government had to strike a difficult balance and couldn't take a course that could expose us to tens of thousands more deaths in very short order. Australia's coronavirus hotspot of Victoria will look into ways to increase testing for the disease to bring its spread under more control and an anticipated easing of the state's stringent lockdown restrictions. That's according to the Victorian Premier, Daniel Andrews. New daily coronavirus infections in Victoria, Australia's second most populous state, fell to 9 cases Monday, down from 12 in the previous days. No deaths were reported. Victoria accounts for 90% of the country's 894 COVID-19 deaths since the start of the year. The state has conducted about 2.7 million tests. Australia has one of the world's highest ratios of tests per capita, and despite the outbreak in Victoria, still one of the lowest numbers of coronavirus cases. The U.S. Supreme Court begins its 9-month term Monday ahead of a battle over confirmation of President Trump's nominee to replace the Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. A Republican bid to invalidate the health care system known as Obamacare in a hotly contested presidential election that could end up being decided by the nation's highest court. And President Trump's nominees to replace Ginsburg, Federal Appeals Court Judge Amy Coney Barrett, is confirmed as expected by Senate controlled by his fellow Republicans. The court's ideological balance would tilt further rightward with a potent 6-3 conservative majority. The court kicks off its term, according to custom, on the first Monday of October. It will hear 2 cases argued by teleconference due to the coronavirus pandemic. The court building, where large crowds of mourners gathered outside after Ginsburg's death on September 18th, remains closed to the public because of the pandemic. Find more at voanews.com. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, October 5th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Euphoria in Sudan following the weekend signing of a comprehensive peace deal.
This peace agreement contains a number of protocols addressing issues relating to different parts of Sudan, in addition to national issues.
A UN official expresses regrets about possible regression by Somalia in adhering to international human rights laws. A lawyer representing Rwanda's Paul Rusesabagina says he was chosen by Rusesabagina, but the family said the lawyer was chosen by the Rwandan government.
We do not recognize that lawyer. This is a lawyer forced on my father to protect him so my father doesn't say the truth, so my father doesn't get out of there. This is a fake lawyer to continue their same trial, and that's what's happening.
And today is International Teachers Day. We'll examine the plight of teachers in Uganda and Zimbabwe amid the COVID-19 pandemic. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley's sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Continues in Sudan and around the world following the weekend signing of a comprehensive peace deal between the Sudan government and the armed movements in the South Sudan capital, Juba. South Sudan President Salva Kiir played a key role in mediating the agreement. The UN, the European Union, and the Troika, comprising Norway, UK, and the United States, all praised the signing. However, SPLM North leader Abdel Aziz Al-Helu did not sign. Sudanese Prime Minister Abdalla Hamdok said the deal was not about power sharing, but a new chapter to replace bullets with development. Ahmed Togo Lisan is the chief negotiator for the Justice and Equality Movement.
This peace agreement contains a number of protocols addressing issues relating to different parts of Sudan, in addition to national issues. We conducted the peace process in different tracks. The first track was addressing issues of Darfur. In Darfur, basically, we negotiated issues relating to return of IDPs and refugees. We negotiated on issues of land and restitution. We also addressed issues in the two areas, which is the Nuba Mountains and Blue Nile. We also discuss issues relating to the national matters at the national level.
So is this deal a power-sharing deal, meaning now you can be in a transitional government?
Well, it's not a power-sharing deal. Basically, power-sharing is one of the issues, but mainly we discussed too many issues relating to development, constitutional reform, constitutional conference, issues relating to addressing the consequences of the war. So too many issues. And that's why I'm saying this agreement is comprehensive.
What do you want to say to, say, groups like the SPLM North of Abdel Aziz Al-Helu, who we understand did not sign the agreement?
Abdel Aziz Al-Helu is still negotiating in Juba, have not yet reached an agreement. But hopefully, after the finishing of this process, he will start negotiating on issues relating to the two areas. So in terms of his involvement, he is a part of this process. And possibly he is going to reach a peace agreement soon.
So what's the next step?
The next step, we are entering into the phase of the implementation of the peace agreement. In the coming 2 weeks, the cabinet, the council of ministers in Khartoum, in addition to the council of the sovereign council in Sudan, jointly will hold a meeting to endorse the peace agreement, and then peace agreements will come into force. Then we are going to establish the other mechanisms that created by this agreement in order to form a new government, appoint a new parliament, and then from there we can take it onwards.
Any comment in terms of the role played by President Salva Kiir?
You know, the conflict of Sudan is a very complicated conflict, involved two different parties. And in too many regions, other countries and the mediations tried to resolve this conflict over the years, but they all failed. But at the end, President Salva Kiir and the mediation team in South Sudan successfully managed to put an end to the war. So we do appreciate the role of President Salva Kiir and the people of South Sudan, and hopefully they will keep supporting the process until the end of the implementation of this peace agreement.
Ahmed Tugo Lisan is the chief negotiator for the Justice and Equality Movement. He was speaking with us from the South Sudanese capital, Juba. The daughter of Paul Rusesabagina, the man depicted in the Hollywood movie Hotel Rwanda, about Rwanda's 1994 genocide, said if the Rwandan government wants to prosecute her father, it should do so in a real court with his own lawyers representing him and not fake lawyers appointed and paid by the Rwandan government. Rusesabagina is charged with 13 criminal offenses for his alleged connection to the FLN, the militia group that the Rwandan government accuses of terrorism. An appeals court judge last Friday denied Rusesabagina's request for provisional release. Rusesabagina's daughter, Anaïs Kaniba, says the family does not have faith in what she calls the Rwanda kangaroo court to give their father a fair trial.
We've had the chance to speak with him maybe through phone calls. These phone calls, they've been difficult because they are very monitored and he cannot speak his mind because people are with him on the phone calls. The fake lawyers, David Rugazin, others probably in the room, police officers are in the room. So when we want to tell him about important things that can help him, we're not able to do so. Instead, we get pushback from him. He's speaking under duress, you know, he told us he had medication issues and the doctors were giving him medication there. We're like, well, you know, we have our own medication we can give you through the embassy. And he said, no, this is a man who is 66 years old, who has a hypertension, cancer survivor, and who's been taking this medication for a while. And now he says, I'm happy to take the medication of a country that wants to kill me.
Now, I read an article in which the family is appealing to the United States and the European Union to help free your dad. Is this true?
No, yes, that's what we're doing. That's what I'm doing here in Washington, D.C. That's what my family is doing in Europe. We're all working hard to appeal to the United States to help us free my father.
As you know, the Rwandan government has accused your dad of terrorism, including financing the FLN. What do you make of these charges?
So these charges are charges that they've accused my father of 10 years ago. They did not go anywhere. These are allegations that he's used in the past, that he uses to everyone that is vocal against him, that is vocal. When I say vocal against him, that is vocal, that says things that they're doing. Not against him, that's saying the truth. People that say the truth are victims, and they become terrorists to Kagame.
In that same article, an American lawyer said that the Rwandan government would not allow your dad to be represented by lawyers of his choice. But my understanding is that your dad has a Rwandan lawyer, or he has Rwandan lawyers. Does this suggest he doesn't trust those lawyers?
Yes, sir. Listen, these lawyers are pro bono lawyers that can only be given to a client if the client's family cannot afford to pay for him legal representation. Our family has tried to get my father, Gatera Gashabana, one of the top lawyers in Rwanda, to go defend my father. What the government of Rwanda did, knowing consciously our family has tried to give representation to my father, they denied us once, twice, until Tuesday. And instead, on Saturday, this guy, David Rugaza, gave a press conference claiming that he was my father's lawyer, claiming that my father had selected him. So I'm asking you, sir, what kind of lawyer can be working for the government, the same government that's also trying to charge my father, the same government that kidnapped him? How is this lawyer being a good lawyer? We do not recognize that lawyer. This is a lawyer forced on my father to protect him from, so my father doesn't say the truth, so my father doesn't get out of there. This is a fake lawyer to continue their sham trial. And that's what's happening.
Thank you so much for the opportunity to speak with you. I do appreciate it very much.
Thank you very much for your time.
Anaïs Kaniba is the daughter of Paul Rusesabagina of Rwanda. She was speaking with us from Washington, D.C. In Rwanda, one of the lawyers representing Paul Rusesabagina said he and the other lawyers were chosen by Rusesabagina himself. This after Rusesabagina's family accused the lawyers of working for the Rwandan government to deceive their father. Lawyer David Rugaza says he and the other lawyers were chosen by the court to provide pro bono service for Rusesabagina. He says he has made every effort to communicate with Rusesabagina's family in the United States and Belgium, but they have not responded. An appeals court judge last Friday denied Rusesa Bagina's request for provisional release. Still, lawyer David Rugasa says he's hopeful his client will be granted a provisional release before his trial.
We were ready for anything which may come as the next, but we can't say that the next is trial because the provisional detention means if someone is granted a provisional detention, that is the request from the prosecution to which the prosecution has two options. Prosecution may find that there are serious grounds which can motivate them maybe to submit the case to court. That's where the trial can go on. That's why we say we are waiting for them, but everything which is supposed to be done, it has to be taken within 30 days.
Now, are you in touch with the family in terms of whether they agreed for you to represent him?
Lawyers who are assisting Rusesa Bagina are the lawyers who have been chosen by himself. And, of course, being in touch of the family, we have tried our best. So we have communicated to them. I personally, I did several communications. I've sent so many messages, though they were not been replying, but we have done our best. Like yesterday, I even updated them about the situation of today that we are waiting for the court decision. Unfortunately, they have been reading the messages, but they have not replied.
How did you come to represent him? Were you chosen by the government of Rwanda or by the family of Mr. Rusesa Bagina?
I was not been chosen by the government. I was selected by Rusesa Bagina. In Rwanda, there is a process called pro bono. Pro bono is the service which is given for someone who doesn't have a lawyer. That is normally the process which is required by the Rwanda Bar Association. Rwanda Bar Association select at least a number of lawyers who will represent in the court of law people who do not have the lawyers. It is at the same thing that the list was being submitted to Rusesa Bagina. I was among the people who were on that list. Together with that, even our CVs was presented to him. He made a choice. He even called people to have some kind of interview in order to test and see whether he's really going to choose people from his choice. And that's what has been done. We made an interview with him after reading our CVs, and that's where he finally elected me. I was chosen by himself as he testified.
So will you still be representing him during the trial?
Yeah, since we're still together and since he have confessed that he wants me, I will represent him until when he may think that he maybe want to take somebody else or until when the trial may end. Depends to his choice.
David Urugasa is one of the court-appointed lawyers for Paul Rusesa Bagina of Rwanda. He was speaking with us from the capital, Kigali. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, October 5th. A UN human rights investigator is expressing regrets about possible regression by Somali authorities from their adherence to international human rights law. These concerns are amplified in a report submitted to the UN Human Rights Council by the UN's independent expert on the situation of human rights in Somalia. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
Isha Difan was appointed independent expert on Somalia in March during the COVID-19 pandemic, keeping her from going there. Though she says information gathered remotely from numerous sources strongly indicates Somali authorities are regressing on commitments to protect people's economic, social, and cultural rights. She acknowledges the country's armed conflict and humanitarian crises have been worsened by the pandemic and a locust infestation.
There have been reports of attacks against healthcare and aid workers, excessive use of force by law enforcement agencies resulting in the death of civilians, violations of the right to freedom of expression and opinion, and an increase in sexual and gender-based violence and forced evictions during the pandemic.
Difan says she's particularly troubled by long-standing and deeply rooted patterns of prejudice, discrimination, and violence aimed daily at women and girls.
I have continued to hear of incidents of rape and other forms of sexual violence against women, girls, and boys occurring for the most part with impunity, forcing victims and their families to turn to other avenues which seem to provide a semblance of justice, but in reality continue to fuel violence
Somali ambassador to Switzerland and Austria, Abiyan Mohamed Saleh, says her government does not believe it is possible to achieve peace and security without the preservation of human rights. She says Somalia has adopted a human rights-based approach and established institutions to end impunity and violent conflict and to ensure people's rights and freedoms. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Today, Monday, is International Teachers' Day, which highlights the achievements of teachers and the challenges they face, particularly during the COVID-19 pandemic. As we hear in this report by Mugumi Davis Rakarijin in Kampala, some Ugandan teachers are devising ways to earn a living amid the COVID-19 school closures.
Sophia Nabwegamo, a primary school teacher, sits under an umbrella at Nakasero Market in Kampala as she waits on clients. She deals in fresh foods, mainly vegetables and fruits. The single mother of five says life has become more challenging since schools were closed in March this year as one of the measures aimed at stopping the spread of COVID-19 disease.
We are paid that very month of March since then, so we are in the market here striving to look for what we eat, what we cater for. We used to cater for our children.
Nabwegamo, who teaches science in middle primary school, earns 500,000 Uganda shillings, or about $150 per month, just enough to cater for her family's basic needs, leaving her with no savings. After spending 2 months without earning an income, she borrowed 150,000 Uganda shillings, or about $40, from friends with which she used to set up her business. She now earns from it 30 to 40,000 Uganda shillings, or about $10 daily, to feed her family. Just like her, most teachers in private run schools are not receiving any salaries. Francis Kato, a mathematics teacher at a government-aided Gabba Demonstration primary school, says he's lucky he still earns a salary. But Kato says it is not enough, and he now has to practice farming to supplement his income.
Most of us, we are being given some allowances at the end of the year, at the end of the month, and some parents, we are catering for some of our needs. Like a parent could come and say, "Teacher Kato, please, can you help me and make a follow-up of my child? I will give you something as a token of appreciation."
He says some of his colleagues have resorted to driving taxi motorcycles, while others hawk foodstuffs and domestic materials. Primary school teachers in Uganda earn an average of 400,000 Uganda shillings, or about $100 per month. Philibert Waguma, the general secretary of Uganda Teachers Union, says teachers need financial and psychosocial support to cope with the effects brought about by COVID-19 disease.
The head teachers, heads of education institutions, need to be supported. We need to build their capacity to handle the new normal. The teachers have been away from school for 6 months, doing all sorts of other things. The learners have not been in a school setup for 6 months. So when they come, they are not the other ones who were in school that time.
The theme of this year's International Teachers' Day is Teachers Leading Crisis, Reimagining the Future, emphasizing the role teachers must play in helping cope with the coronavirus pandemic. Indeed, Nabwegamo says she'll be ready to go back to teach once called back.
If you accept to lend a service, you have to fulfill. I'll have, of course, to go back and do my professional job. I love teaching and I cannot leave it.
For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
The Zimbabwe National Teachers Union has rejected an appeal from the government to return to school. Manuel Nyawo, chief executive officer of the union, says the teachers are not motivated to return to work because they don't have the capacity. The Zimbabwe government announced last month that it had allocated $600 million for schools to improve sanitation in preparation for reopening. However, Nyawo says the government must pay the teachers livable salaries on par with other civil servants, including payment of their COVID-19 allowances of $150, which was promised but never paid.
I can tell you that No teacher is motivated to return to the classroom in response to the call from the Minister of Public Service, Professor Mavima. Apparently, and precisely because the issues that we have since presented to the employer has not been addressed. We just received a paltry cushion of not more than 1,500 dollars, and that money is a drop in the ocean. We are saying we are heavily incapacitated. We have failed to send our own children to schools. The children are still with us, and the boarding schools are charging up to 40,000 RTGS when a teacher is getting not more than 4,000 RTGS.
Help me to understand the salaries you want. Are these new salaries, or what are you demanding?
We are demanding salary increase because apparently the disparity that is there between ourselves as teachers and what our counterparts in the nursing fraternity, the disparities are glaring, and we cannot accept that. How would you see a situation where there's a difference of more than 9,000 or so, yet we hold much more qualifications than those other counterparts that you are talking about? You know, a salary that cannot allow us to send our own children to school is no salary at all.
Manuel Nyawo is the Chief Executive Officer of the Zimbabwe National Teachers Union. He was speaking with us from the capital, Harare. It's time now for Daybreak Africa's Post, and here is Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you too, James. We begin the sports with the London Marathon, which was held on Sunday. Kenya's Bridget Kosgei successfully defended her London Marathon title on the wet St. James's Park on Sunday, producing a brilliant solo run to claim a fourth career win in the 42.2 kilometers race. Kosgei clocked 2 hours, 18 minutes, 58 seconds, crossing the line ahead of American Sarah Hall, who timed a personal best of 2 hours, 22 minutes, 1 second. Bridget Kosgei couldn't hide her excitement after the race.
Due to corona, we have not prepared well, and then weather affect us. There is some wind and there is rain all the way, so it makes us our muscles to be compact, so no body becoming warm, so it's difficult for us to finish. And then I try my best after I finish good.
Kenya's world champion Ruth Chepngetich rounded out the podium just 4 seconds adrift of Hall. In the men's category, world record holder Eliud Kipchoge was beaten in the London Marathon as Shura Kitata won a thrilling sprint finish to claim an unexpected victory. In cold, wet conditions, Kitata edged clear to win in a relatively slow sprint finish in 2 hours, 5 minutes and 41 seconds. Four-time winner Eliud Kipchoge was a favorite but fell behind with 2 laps to go and finished 8th. Kipchoge blamed ear and hip problems for his surprise defeat.
The race was good. I started out well. The horse goes well, but I got just a slight problem with my right ear. I got blocked, and I tried to do all the necessary to make sure that I tried to hop in, but it was not possible. But all in all, is that this is sport. Sport is whereby today you are up, tomorrow you are down.
And now to some tennis news. Tunisia's Ons Jabeur became the first Arab woman to reach the fourth round of the French Open as she beat 8th seed Aryna Sabalenka 7-6, 7-2, 6-6, 3 on Saturday. The 30th seed displayed her trademark court craft to undermine Sabalenka's raw power as she surpassed her previous best third round showing at Roland Garros in 2017. The Tunisian, who became the first Arab woman to reach a Grand Slam quarterfinal in Australia this year, said the key to her win was staying calm and weathering the storm. And on to Zimbabwe, where the Zimbabwe Rugby Union has completed interviews for vacant coaching positions, with all appointments set to be made before the end of this month. ZRU advertised all national team coaching positions except for the Sables technical staff headed by Brendan Dawson, which was beefed up and given a target to qualify for the 2023 Rugby World Cup. And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good day.
And that's it for this Monday, October 5th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting your week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing you a very good week.